core to the strategy is that you have this piece of news, usually a funding round, that's exclusive, and you bring it to one person. You say, if you're willing to cover this, we'll give you the story exclusively. I feel like there are a lot of people who are early stage that still want to like blast it out to a lot of people, and then you get nothing. And so I think leveraging the sense that this is going to run exclusively with you is key to the strategy early on. You should think about if you're announcing your Series A with me and if I'm scooping your Series A as very different story types, right? Like, because if I'm scooping the Series A, I'll do whatever I want. Maybe you could on background sort of help me. And savvy comms people get that even if they don't like the scoop, it's a marketing moment. I would also say about those stories where they're scoops, you normally get two bites at the apple, right? Like you normally get my scoop and then Forbes will still do the announcement. You know, it's new to announce it. So reporters are usually willing to cover it both times. The other type of story, which I'm doing more now, which is like a classic TechCrunch sort of story where it's like, we're announcing the Series A with you. My standards for that are honestly higher because it needs to be totally exclusive, but I'm also giving you more central treatment. Like I'm less likely to sort of mix that into another story.
Welcome to The Peel, where we explore the world's greatest startup stories. I'm your host, Turner Novak, founder of Nan Capital, a venture capital firm with the most newsletter subscribers. I'm excited to share this conversation with Eric Newcomer. Eric was the very first employee at The Information and spent 6 years at Bloomberg before starting his own newsletter, Newcomer, in 2020 to report on startups and venture capital for insiders. He's since scaled the business to over 80,000 subscribers, over $1 million in annual revenue, a few employees, and is notably profitable. In that time, he's broken countless stories like SBF's leaked email to investors the day FTX collapsed, surveys where founders ranked their VCs, surveys where VCs ranked themselves, and leaked fundraising decks from Coatue and Tiger. Eric gives us the insider's perspective on the current media landscape, goes into his reporting strategy around what he covers, and shares a framework for how to pitch stories to reporters. We also get into why he started hosting events and how they become his most profitable business line, including his newest, the Newcomer Banking Summit, which hosts its inaugural event a week after this episode goes live and 1 year after the Silicon Valley Bank crisis. If you're interested in startups, venture capital, and media, this is a can't-miss episode packed with insights from someone at the center of it all. Without further ado, let's jump in. Eric, how's it going? Thanks for coming on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me. Super excited.
So exciting first topic I thought we could dig into. Can you take us inside what is going on in media right now? On the one side, you have a pretty successful, small but growing, scaling team, profitable from what I've seen. And on the other side, there's all these like legacy media publications laying people off. It's kind of been a trend for the last decade or more. Like, what is happening right now in media?
Yeah, I mean, it's a disaster outside of the New York Times, you know, which is still not a great business, but is slowly, you know, a growing one.
Ooh, it's not great. Why do you say it's not great?
I think the New York Times is a good business, but you just compare it to like tech stocks or anything. You know, it's not like the stock is roaring. You know, I'm a journalist, so I don't buy individual stocks. I buy ETFs, so I play a little like stock simulator game. And so, you know, the New York Times is my only media company in it. And I think it's up like 6% or something since I started. Whereas, you know, like going big on Facebook, you know, it was the right bet. So it's just, you know, it's all about what you compare it to. But for media, the New York Times is doing very well. You know, obviously BuzzFeed basically shut down their news business. Insider laid off a bunch of people and is sort of pivoting away from hardcore subscriptions. TechCrunch laid off a small number of people and pivoted away from hardcore subscriptions. So there's a moment in media right now that's turning its back on subscriptions after a narrative that subscriptions are what's going to save us. So I think it's particularly disheartening for the media industry and reporters. Just that it feels like the economy is doing better, like, you know, things are rebounding, but somehow like media didn't get the memo and it's, you know, it's getting worse in that industry. And I feel very fortunate that that's not the situation, you know, at Newcomer. And we can sort of interrogate, I guess, how much Newcomer is or isn't representative of what can happen in media.
Yeah, well, you're kind of in this niche of just covering venture capital, which is the noise that it generates is a lot in like the scale of how much people think they care about it in terms of like what it is. It's a pretty small group of people. It's not that big of an industry at the end of the day.
Thank God I don't cover like the oil industry, right? I mean, the beauty of covering startups and venture capital is that it's simultaneously a business. So there's money, people pay for it, people can expense subscriptions, but it's like culturally relevant. It matters to the future of the world. People care about it in a way beyond just dollars and cents. So even though I'm a publication that's very rooted in helping people to get an information edge to make money, it's still like, you know, a fun topic to read about that when I get a great piece of commentary, it, you know, Slate wants to commission it, or, you know, it just feels like, I mean, it's obviously just a topic of great societal interest, and that makes it much more satisfying to write about and fun. So it's the synergy of being a great business and culturally relevant that I think makes it a great beat for me and a topic area for a newcomer.
So you actually have been like almost on this like reporter journalistic path for a long time. When did it start initially?
Yeah. So I, you know, my parents divorced, I moved to Macon, Georgia. And like one of the things that really gave me a sense of comfort in my new elementary school in fourth grade was that I became an anchor on the elementary school newscast. I got to like interview the superintendent. We had this gruff like TV anchor who advised us. So that really sold me on journalism.
And you were in fourth grade, right? Interviewing the superintendent of the district?
Yeah, exactly. It might have been like fifth. I don't know, but I started in fourth grade. I forget which grade of elementary school.
It's one of those like third or fourth check in Uber type of thing, like fourth or fifth grade.
I feel like I was one of the last people to come up this sort of traditional, like work your way up the regional newspaper internship game. You know, I was at the Macon Telegraph two summers. I went to the Sun Sentinel one summer, the Tampa Bay Times one summer. And then I got to the New York Times right after I graduated from college. And I briefly worked covering like DC City Hall. I had no like express interest in tech up until I got laid off. You know, the newspaper I was working for was shutting down, and Jessica Lesson at The Information was sort of scrambling through, I think, like the Harvard Crimson Alumni Network. And I'd been reaching out to a bunch of people. And so she offered me this job when the company hadn't even been incorporated and she hadn't even named it The Information yet. I joined instead of going to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I worked out of her like apartment in Dolores Park in the beginning. So I was the first employee at The Information, and that's sort of how I stumbled into tech reporting.
So why did she hire you if you had no background in tech? Like, don't you need sources and all that stuff?
Amir Afradi was this very experienced reporter at the Journal that she knew was going to join. And so I think it was an interesting experiment to see like, oh, can you get somebody super junior sort of up to speed? I mean, it was at once, I think the answer is sort of no, but I also think it was a great crash course. Like, I did stories I'm proud of. I broke like Amazon buying Twitch. Like I did real stories, and I think was valuable to them, but it was definitely a brutal way to learn because The Information wants like novel, you know, reporting. Whereas so much of even the New York Times or Bloomberg, where I went after The Information, you know, a good percentage of your stories are thing happened, do a great story on known thing. Whereas to its credit, so much of what The Information wants is true novel reporting. And so, you know, that's extra hard.
Yeah. And it's kind of, they're sort of breaking relevant news. And it's not so much of like, you know, I don't want to say names of any publications, but it's just like someone else broke the story, copy paste.
Right. They get ripped off a lot. And then the tone changes. Well, Insider is the classic where they'll like run an information story and it's just like, yeah.
Are there like behind the scenes of these like media companies like just hate each other because they're just stealing each other's stuff? Or
yeah, well, there's a lot of, I mean, The Information gets mad at the Wall Street Journal. You know, Jessica came from the Journal. Amir came from the Journal. Martin Piers, their main editor, came from the Journal. And so there's clearly, you can see it on Twitter. I'm not like speaking out of school here where there's some sniping about credit and who was on what story first and which stories mattered. So yeah, the media, including myself, you know, were self-absorbed and very interested in the sort of like who got, you know, yeah, who got what scoop for good and bad.
Yeah. So I think there's like that one meme where it's like the tweet is like, I was working on the story for a year and then this guy just tweeted it out or something. If you
exactly.
know that tweet
totally,
I'm talking about.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm just curious then, I wanted to get into this, like, I am not a reporter. I really don't know how this world works. I mean, I guess as much as you can as an outsider, like, how do you get a scoop? How do you build sources? Like, what's a general framework for like a founder or like a VC or anyone, just thinking about like, how do I help a reporter? How do I understand their perspective and what they're going through?
I mean, some of it's relationships. I mean, I think that's why, and we'll get into this, like I've been successful beyond just traditional reporting, that you are building, at if you're a good reporter, real relationships of trust that are based on sort of long-term thinking. And so that's, to me, the best way to get consistent information. You know, it's like you meet people on an early story, you see them at a dinner and you stay in touch. And then there's trust when there's really something juicy or, you know, that would get them in trouble to share. I mean, the advice I always give reporters, and like the best way to get a tip is to ask somebody who didn't sign the NDA or isn't like, what, didn't promise anybody to keep it secret. It's sort of, you know, somebody who was supposed to keep it secret, told other people who are sort of in their world, it feels less egregious to tell. And then once it's out to that sort of outer periphery, they actually don't have much of a duty to protect the company anyway. And then they tell you, and then you go to the people who really know and say, I already know, like, it's already locked. Like, am I an idiot? You know, and then you feel pretty good and you get a couple more sources. And like, I feel like that's a repeatable pattern. And part of what I'm doing is saying, you know, these companies are not great at keeping, they don't do enough work to keep secrets necessarily. You know, they like let a bunch of VCs look at their documents. Like, there's a whole sort of industry of people buying secondaries. They're sort of pseudo public in some cases, where they're sharing a lot of information with this group of insiders. And I'm saying, okay, let's make that circle a little bigger if you're going to be so reckless with how you hold information and expand it out. You know, I feel like it's much rarer, though not never, but where, you know, like it's like just a board just like cavalierly giving stuff up versus, you know, you did a bit, you told all your employees, you did a big secondary. You know, it's when these circles get big that information gets to the public.
So then how do you decide what is a worthy enough story? Like when you talk about, you know, the secondary still happened, like I'm just making up a company maybe that people know of, like ByteDance or something, big tech secondary sale, ByteDance owns TikTok, super relevant. Like, how do you decide like, okay, this is worth reporting on this secondary sale that happened? Like, is there a certain trade-off to like not newsworthy versus being newsworthy, and whether it's for you or just the industry at large?
I love a story that sort of has lots of exclusive tidbits that I throw in. You know, my dream newcomer story sort of surprises you that three quarters down, I had some scoop that I'm not really hyping up. And so you need to be sort of dialed in to pay attention to those tidbits. So I would say to some degree, it's like, if I can find a theme that pulls together a bunch of smaller stories, maybe, you know, one secondary wouldn't be the headline, but like a lower, you know, it'd be lower in the story somewhere on a theme.
Okay. So when you talk about almost like burying the lead deep in an article, do you have any examples of articles you've written? Maybe we'll link to them in the show notes too, so people can check them out. But like, what's a good example?
On that sort of example, like several years ago, I did like, consumers dead, but investors like want it back anyway. You know, it's sort of, you know, it was like leading into 2021. It might've been 2020, where it's just like, okay, we're doing consumer, even though there aren't like, there isn't like a platform shift necessarily.
We need to raise money, or we already did. We need to deploy the fund.
And so I think I had like, you know, Jeremy Levine and Sarah Tavel had like, you know, done some undisclosed like tutoring company. You know, it's like I had some of their early stage deals. I mean, part of the fun for me is that it can be, you know, scooping seed in Series A company, you know, is like exciting because readers really want to know like what's happening with, what are the partners at Benchmark, Sequoia, Andreessen doing in Series A rounds? Whereas like, you know, the New York Times scooping a Series A is a little small. I mean, I broke the seed and Series A of Be Real, which I did as a sort of Be Real headline, but that was super fun. Like, I like to sort of call like this company. I mean, I wish it had done better because it would be better for me to be, you know, like I wrote the Series A of like Flexport, which did better, but like Be Real definitely was a hot company that I was like, this is coming. And, you know, I feel like I wrote about it 6 months before they really maybe got the traction that got them the broader coverage.
Yeah. I remember that. Because I invested in the seed round, which, so, I mean, the context for you and everyone listening. So we signed the docs for the seed round, but we hadn't actually wired the money yet when I think you had like announce the Series A or something like the scoop, and
not an approved scoop. That was, yeah. That, I mean, not the company did not announce it. I scooped it. Yeah.
Just remember being like, what happens? Like, do I still get to invest? I haven't sent the money yet.
But you did, right? Did it change anything?
Yeah, no, we did. We did still invest. I was like, it was a very large different in valuation from when I invested. So it changed the math quite a bit if like I had to do the Series A or if I didn't get to invest at all. Yeah, I remember we were thinking like, how did he get that? We were all like, what happened here? I think I have a guess, but I'm not going to say it on the podcast. Maybe I'll ask you afterwards. I think I have some context clues, but anyways, so that's like a dream story for you then, is like pretty big, relevant. I remember it was like Excel, DST, and A16Z that like co-led.
Yeah, people are competing for it. You know, I love the, you know, top firms are gunning for this startup.
I remember you, it was like, if I'm remembering that story specifically, it was A16Z had like flown to Paris to meet him. But I think one of the other funds, or both the other funds, like only met on Zoom or something. And like they won the deal because they actually went and saw the founder versus, you know, just taking it from their ski lodge or whatever. It's like, it gives people an idea of how those things happen.
This is super in the weeds, but just given a lot of founders listen to this, I'd say they're... You should think about if you're announcing your Series A with me and if I'm scooping your Series A as very different story types, right? Like, because if I'm scooping the Series A, I'll do whatever I want. Like, I might throw in any other company. You know, it's like, it's my stuff. I got it. You're not helping me. Like, that maybe you can, like, sometimes people try to be like, oh, we'll really help you in like 3 months. And I'm like, no way. Maybe you could on background sort of help me and you'll get like, I mean, I am on those types of stories. Like, if you help me, I'll be definitely willing to like write a more fulsome description of like what you do. And like, you know, sometimes there are these weird, you know, technical startups where it's like, I'd love, you know, to like make more of what the investors see in you. You could like jump on board and like give me that. And savvy comms people get that even if they don't like the scoop, it's a marketing moment. I would also say about those stories where they're scoops, you normally get two bites at the apple, right? Like, you normally get my scoop and then Forbes will still do the announcement. You know, Alex Conrad is not necessarily saying, you know, it's new to announce it. So reporters are usually willing to cover it both times. The problem is you scare a bunch of investors who haven't wired their money and like everything is, everything's not, I's aren't dotted, T's aren't crossed, et cetera. The other type of story, which I'm doing more now, which is like, you know, a classic TechCrunch sort of story where it's like, we're announcing the Series A with you. That I'm much more, sometimes my standards for that are honestly higher because it needs to be totally exclusive, but I'm also giving you more central treatment. Like, I'm less likely to sort of mix that into another story. I'm more mindful of the fact that like, I wouldn't do it unless I felt like, oh, this is worth paying attention to, and I'm going to give it sort of the attention that it deserves. And so my mentality on those is a little different. To me, they're like totally different types of stories.
Yeah. Do you think of certain stories in the sense of like, this is going to drive subscriber growth, like free, this is going to drive like paid conversions, which is like obviously like a little bit more helpful? Or is it just like, this is relationship building?
Well, my conversion strategy has honestly become almost entirely paywall driven. So I can just sort of set the paywall higher or lower depending on a bunch of factors.
You mean on the page, like how high you place it?
How much is free and how much you have to pay to read. So it's like, if you're announcing with me, you came to me, maybe I set the paywall lower because I'm like, okay, you know, you want to come because you know I'm going to deliver my 80,000 free readers, not my 2,000 plus paid readers. So more of it will be free versus like if it's scoop, it's like I did the work, I got it, it's mine. Like, maybe I paywall like after like a paragraph or two paragraphs where I'm just basically marketing the story to the free list, but then the paywall is like very aggressive and most of the content is for paid readers. And then, you know, if it's like a cultural piece, like, you know, I've done sort of columns about Sam Altman and Chamath, I was sort of warning about them in different contexts, and you know, those I made free just because it's like, oh, I want to, it's more of a talker, you know, it's less like for the money, whereas stuff that's very financial, I'm much more likely to paywall super tightly.
And some of it's probably brand building too, where it's just like, hey, I was the person that made you first start thinking about this. So then it's like an important topic and you're like, you changed the tone of how the entire industry, you know, thought processed a certain topic. I think the one that I thought was funny headline was the Chamath, like the scam in the arena.
Scary story to send, but it's like, dude, like it's so true. I had to send it. The whole premise of that story was like, I didn't shit on him when the SPACs fail. You know, it was sort of like buyer beware. But then when he was, it was like a year later, he was on Twitter just like dunking on people for like not doing their own like work on it. It's just like, well, yeah, it hurts your reputation is tanked by like screwing over a bunch of people. Anyway, yeah, I stand by that story, but certainly the all-in people have been a little cold to me. Chamath literally at one point recommended my newsletter on all-in. And I mean, but you know, Silicon Valley, I think one thing that frustrates me about all-in is the extent to which they don't acknowledge Silicon Valley is all about these relationships. You know, it's very, you know, a lot of their opinions are shaped by obviously rooting for Elon Musk, but you know, their relationships and investments. And I feel like they can sometimes obscure that for their broader audience.
Yeah, they've done a very good job positioning themselves as, you know, insiders and, you know, ask college kids, like what podcasts you listen to. And they're like, I love All In.
I like it sometimes. I mean, when David Sachs isn't talking about politics, but.
Yeah, like I said, I think they've done a good job of like the goals they're trying to achieve. I think they've done a good job of like reaching the goals that they want. So, you know. It's, you know, congrats to them. People love it. So I'm curious then, when you decided, I'm going to start this newcomer thing, I'm going to quit my job at Bloomberg, I'm going to start a Substack. Like that was probably kind of like a crazy thing back in, I think it was October of 2020 was when you announced it.
Literally when the day I was going to quit, I like had my call with my editor and I didn't quit. And my now wife was like, you've got to do it, like do it, you know, like pull the band-aid off.
So we're going into the call like, I'm gonna quit, but then you didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it was our morning check-in and there was some like, oh, which editor should I tell first, should I tell my top boss, or like, so there was a little, but it was like I definitely sort of thought I was going to tell him like I'm quitting, and then just like, anyway, so I quit. You know, you call, I like called everybody, it's the pandemic, so you're like, hey, I'm out, blah, 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 blah.
It's, you can't like go office to office, it's like literally like the Zoom. Yeah.
And Bloomberg is like a bank, and then they're like, you're out of here, you know, once you're done. So there's definitely a like, oh, I should rapidly sort of tell people this is happening. I mean, it was sort of a combination of things. One, I mean, I love my time at Bloomberg, you know, I was there almost 6 years, but it's a very sort of serious news, no opinion sort of place, especially when I was there. And I wanted, you know, Ben Smith had this great column in the New York Times about media at the time. And I wanted much more of that style where he's like got scoops, but he's got voice and you're sort of mixing it together and you're sort of directly saying what you think. And there's no like game of like, what's this reporter trying to lead me to here? So part of it was sort of journalistic style and what I wanted there and more control over my stories. And then the other was just, you know, I covered startups for many years. And finally, you know, I saw a Substack coming up. And it's like, oh, here's a trend. You know, while I'm not going to invest, it's at least a trend that is like, well, that means something to me. I should like get on it early. And yeah, I think that was a smart move. I think being early, being able to say I'm quitting during the pandemic, I'm like risking it all, certainly was, you know, appealing to readers and helped me get some early support.
Yeah. So then it seems like you're framing maybe today, and maybe it was the same back then, but it was like writing for the experts.
A key premise is I don't want to have to explain who like Marc Andreessen and Bill Gurley is. It's like stupid to read like this sort of, you know, I'm a VC and you're like reminding me, you're like who it is. It's just like, no, the whole premise is that you know who these people are, you know why they matter. Like, and so we're getting into the like what's going on in Sequoia without the New York Times sort of sweepy sentence of like, oh, it applies to all VC and like it's a symbol of, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's like, no, we care because it's happening in Sequoia and Sequoia matters. And like, there's no more. I mean, sometimes I try to zoom out, but it's just like, I'm perfectly happy to write a story about one of the big firms just because it's important to know what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of cases, it's like A16Z writes a blog post about a new category they're investing in, and half the industry is now investing in that category also.
Well, American like dynamism. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, or Web3. I mean, the return of consumer, like literally.
AI,
I mean,
they were late. They've gotten way too much credit for like, they really leaned in on brand, but they were not early to the AI race.
Yeah, I don't think so. And actually, from what I've heard, friends, they're like, yeah, at A16Z, they're like, yeah, don't send me anything that's not an AI company. It's not getting through IC. Like, we're not investing in anything that's not AI.
Well, like David Kahn, it's Coatue did a ton of AI investments and then went to Sequoia. I feel like he's been super early. I mean, there are lots. But yeah, I don't think Andreessen was early on that. I mean, they were so Web3, and in some ways, crypto and AI had somewhat different philosophies. And I think they sort of had to get their head around embracing AI.
Yeah. I mean, on crypto, they definitely did a good job of the biggest winner, owned a lot of it. I know their first crypto fund did pretty well. So, you know, props. So I'm curious, when you're thinking about, I'm going to quit my job and start a new thing, like, who did you look up to for inspiration? How did you make the decision? Like,
Bill Gurley was one of the first venture capitalists I told. So that was fun.
Why'd you tell him first?
I'd known him a lot from the Uber days. I covered a lot of the Uber saga. I thought it'd be interesting to get his perspective. And he was very generous. Like, when I put up the paywall, he gave me an interview.
Yep. I was going to ask about that. He was the first one after the paywall. That's a good juicy, like, I'm sure you got a couple hundred paid subs from that.
Well, he was so generous in that he said, like, what would be most useful? You know, sort of like, I was like, are you willing to do the paywall? Like, you know, and he was like, whatever's most helpful. And then he gave like a really great endorsement, and that was super nice. And Dara at Uber gave me an interview super early.
And this was probably because, going back, you had spent a long time covering Uber. So you probably just got to know them. And in terms of like building relationships, it's like, I'm sure you scooped stuff Bill didn't like, or you talked to him and like you guys got to know each other. So same with Dara. It's probably like, you know, he had to get to know you, and you had to get to know him anyway. So,
right. I mean, obviously, you know, the skill of the beat at Bloomberg was playing, being like, oh, I've got the Travis side sources, I've got the company side sources, I've got the investor antagonist side sources, and like being like, oh, I got information from them, like, okay, you know, wheeling and sort of dealing on that whole thing. I mean, I broke the video of Travis arguing with the driver. I think I broke, well, a lot of like financially stuff, like Didi buying Uber's China business. I think I broke not Travis resigning, but Travis taking a leave. And then, but Brad Stone and I, you know, who's now the boss at Business Week, did a magazine cover story about like Travis after. And that was super, super negative on Travis. So I think I sort of lost Travis world after that. But before that, they were more, you know, factual.
Yeah. So how do you make that decision as a reporter to like, I don't want to say like cut someone off, but you probably knew like this probably won't be received that well. Like, how do you, what kind of things do you weigh of like how to make a hard decision like that?
I mean, at the end of the day, I feel like I'm doing it to be honest. And like, part of what makes me a good reporter is like the personality disposition. That the things I get most agitated are the things that it feels like I can't say. So more recently, when like all of Twitter was like, team Sam Altman. Sam Altman is God, and like the OpenAI board members are idiots, and Kara Swisher is like beating the drum on Twitter. It felt like so unanimous that I was just like, this is insane. Like, let's take a beat. Like, look at the history and everything. And I mean, I was very like measured, but it was just like, I feel like sometimes when it's just like the thing you can't say, it's just like personality wise, I want to like touch the plate. So that's always appealing. I mean, there's obviously some sense of like, oh man, like, you know, what's this going to do for my sources? If I, you know, you want to be fair. I mean, one thing I always observe is just like, as soon as like when Trump lost the presidential election, or as soon as somebody loses power, they like, the reporters all sort of like all of a sudden shift there. It becomes much less favorable to the person who loses power. Like, so like, clearly like an impulse of reporting is like, towards power, and like, so you have to balance that. But like, you know, there are a lot of factors, but at the end of the day, I'm trying to just like report the thing that I think is most honest based on talking to a lot of people, and I have much more flexibility now of just sort of saying it directly rather than like these weird, I think what so much of tech people hate about media is these weird like there was just a story about Gary Tan and like some, you know, a sort of tech money influencing San Francisco. And it's like, if it were a straightforward story about like where the money's coming from, like, great, that's like journalism. But the tone was so negative and like, you know, billionaires and like just ominous that, you know, you can tell where the reporters stand, and then they act like, you know, it's just reporting.
Yeah, it's like he's just trying to have people not do drugs in the street anymore. Like, you're attacking him for that. Like, come on.
I agree with him. But I just think even if I didn't, it would be much more sincere for the reporters to be like, we don't support this. Like, here's some facts, you know. But I feel like laundering their opinion through sort of this sort of ominous style is like really frustrating to people.
Interesting. So then do you try to avoid that? Like, it seems like you're kind of like facts, but opinion, but it's not like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, how would you describe it to people?
I'm fundamentally driven by reporting. The opinion pieces I like best are when I'm sort of just taking what smart people tell me and like, that's a great take. And like, I could be ahead of the ball by being like, I should call, this is going to happen. So it's like driven. I don't have like, for the most part, these like super strong screeds that I'm like trying to get launder into the, you know, the world, but like, it's more like what's going to happen and like factual. So I see it as driven by that. But then I'm just like, I just try to be direct about what I think. Like, I wrote about Sequoia's like political paradox is my first story. Literally when I launched, and it was about, you know, that Doug Leone ran the firm is this like Fox News watching Republican, yet like so much of their business is made in China, and like Republicans were turning against China, and obviously then everybody else did, and then the firm broke up. But like, I had a line in there that was just like, I find supporting Trump like terrible, you know, or whatever, you know. I just feel like it's better to be like, where is this person coming from? Even though, and I think my readers know that ultimately, if I got a good scoop on something that was like maybe harmful to my ideological interests, I'd still write it, you know.
Yeah, so there's almost like some intellectual honesty to it, but you're still like, hey, I'm like disclosing my bias. Like, I hate this guy, but I'm still telling, or like this candidate or presidential, whatever. Like, I disagree, but like, here's the facts that I know. So then so that was the very first article was the, I think I remember, so I scrolled through every single article. I have not read all of them over the years just because, you know, no one has 100% open rate on emails, but I do remember that was like your very first one. Was that like strategic that you picked that first, or?
No, I feel like, well, it's strategic and it's like lack of strategy, which is like, yeah, people are beholden to like Sequoia, you know. It's like, that's the power. If you're going to do a newsletter that's sort of in industry accumulating power, you do sort of something favorable to Sequoia. But like, and I've said in the newsletter, again, this is where I'll express my opinion, I think they're the best firm. Like, they're certainly the most well-respected. But, you know, that I was willing to come out of the gate and sort of like go at sort of the king, I think showed that this is like going to be a sort of fiercely independent newsletter still aimed at people in the industry.
That's fair. I think, I mean, that showed up too when you think about like how highly people think of certain firms. There was that opinion survey thing.
I published a survey of like limited partner surveyed venture capitalists on who they thought the top firms were. And Sequoia was number one. I think Founders Fund may have been number two. USV was up there. Benchmark was up there. Yeah.
Alad Gill, I think, was like pretty high. I think it was like Nat Friedman. So the interesting thing with that was, I think it was like the day or two before you published, I was getting dinner with a couple of people, and like it came up and we all went around and was like, without knowing the answers, we answered the question. And it was really interesting to compare the results of like what people picked. We spent a lot of time like dissecting the questions. So like strategically, like I think my emerging funds were Adjacent, Footwork, and Sam Altman's fund. Those were like my three. But the thing is, like, how do you consider someone an emerging manager versus like, is Footwork not emerging? Cause Nikhil like has a couple companies that are going to IPO, you know, anyways, it was an interesting story.
But that was before the story, right?
I think it was a night or two before you published it.
I mean, that was part of what I was saying in the story, which is like, this thing is being talked about, you know, like, it's on the one hand, sort of a random survey, but it's just like, man, everybody is like pinging me about this. Like, and that's sort of where I can do stuff that traditional media can't, where it's like, yeah. And I started the story off being like, this is not the end all be all like ranking of VCs, but it's just like, it's like a, you know, cocktail party sort of conversation.
I'm sure if you published that or took that survey a year prior or whenever crypto was a thing, it would have been all the crypto funds that were at the top. So the other one that was super interesting that you published was, it was like the Founders Choice leaderboard. I did pretty well on that one. So I was happy about that one. But yeah, that was interesting because it was the ELO ranking, where it's like you pair up the two investors on the cap table based on like public Crunchbase data, and the founders picked which firm they would like, Banana Capital or Sequoia. So it's like, you know, if I got picked above Sequoia, I'm like,
you'd shoot up the rankings. Yeah.
That one's interesting when it's thinking like, what if founders actually care about versus like, what if VCs?
The first two, I wasn't, I didn't like conduct the survey. I published it exclusively, but we're sort of taking it over, working with the guys who do it. So we'll do another one, but extremely busy at the moment. So I'm like, maybe in the fall. I get a lot of pings from marketing people at VC firms being like, are you doing that? Like, do I?
Yeah, there are some interesting flips from the first version of the survey to the second.
I know, Andreessen went way up. Kosla went way up. Like, Kosla, yeah.
Good comms people, good marketing people there.
Certainly, I'm open that I think if you get, you know, obviously, if you can figure out which founders like you and make sure those founders vote in the survey, you will do better.
Yeah, I got to do that. When you run it, I'm just going to ping everyone.
Yeah, I will write an email saying, I am doing the survey again. Please submit your votes.
So is that another thing? Is that a good growth driver? Like, when you think of subs or?
I mean, I think that one's a little more free. I mean, the VC survey, I paywalled the results.
Genius. How many did that drive? You probably made like 50,000 bucks just from people trying to see the results.
I think it was probably like 10,000 bucks. If I assume that like half the people churn, you know, and like, it was like a little, it was 100 something, maybe it was 140 or something.
What types of stories typically do the best? It's kind of, I think it's like the leaked, anything leaked. I think we...
People love to see documents. Like, that is, as much as like I and other reporters fashion ourselves writers, like, people love primary sources. My most viral story at Bloomberg was like the video of Travis arguing. My best stories at Newcomer have been like, here are Coatue's fundraising documents. Here are Tiger's fundraising documents. Here is the email Sam Bankman-Fried sent to investors while FTX is crumbling. I think those are the top three. You know, I'm always proud when sort of a more like written sort of scoopy one gets, in, you know, there's some in the top 10, I think. But like, one of the stories I'm proudest of that is not, you know, those three, the Tiger, FTX, and Coatue, was I did like this list of like a bunch of scoops of software unicorns that had raised at $1 billion valuation or more with less than 10 million in ARR. So it was like peak bubble behavior. And I think I published the story at literally the top of the public market. So to me, that was sort of like the top of the private markets. And like, you know, many of those companies are sort of will never meet that valuation again. And it was like, you know, some of them had like zero revenue and raising a $1 billion valuation. So that, I think that one did well, but it wasn't like, people want to, you know, I, to the extent, if you want to help Newcomer.
Leak some Slack deck. I'll send you my next fund. I'll just send you the deck. And
exactly. Well, I do think we can get more into that. You know, I think, I mean, Insider has a strategy of publishing startup decks that the startups give them. I do think to some degree people want, you know, there are all these VCs that are resentful that their reputation is worse than their returns. And I'm like, that's very solvable. You know, just start sharing your returns, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's kind of, there's just like weird dynamic where I don't know how true this is, but I've always thought this. It's like, the better your website is, the worse your returns probably are. I don't know how true that is. I'm like afraid. I haven't updated my website in like 3 years. It's just like a bunch of text. It's like a crappy Squarespace template. I've been like afraid to make my website better because I'm just like, what does this say about me? Like, am I compensating?
Some of these VC websites are insane. Like, it's like you've over-designed it to the point it is less user-friendly.
Well, I'm starting to think about, should I just redesign it to optimize for converting to my newsletter and like listening to my podcast and like follow me on Twitter? Like, I don't even care what companies I invested in. Like, well, I do. I think there's like interesting, I've actually heard some VCs will put like tracking links on the portfolio page of their website and like tell their portfolio companies, like, I sent you like 50 clicks. Whatever, like this week or month. That's kind of interesting. I don't know. I don't know if that's, is that like the big value add you want to be providing?
Doesn't seem like a lot of traffic. Like, it would have to be way more than 50, I feel like. Yeah.
Probably like the A16C Sequoias of the world that you got like, probably got like tens of thousands of clicks per day.
Andreessen, you know, is driving real attention and is a media company in some ways. I mean, bigger than me, certainly.
So then talking about like media company, How or when did you decide to throw up the paywall? I think you had at least 10,000 subs, like free subs, right?
I think so. I forget, honestly. I knew that I was going to put up a paywall and that it would be a subscription strategy. I basically launched with no paywall very openly, but you could pay. But I gave a huge discount if you paid up front. And then when I put up the paywall, you know, I started off at like $150 a year but it was discounted to $99 for the first year. And I've since moved it to $200 a year. So I have sort of a blend of people paying $150 and $200 and $15 a month or $199. Or sorry, $19 a month. Yeah.
So then was there a moment where you knew that this whole thing was going to work, where you're just like, oh my God, this is a business. Like, I can do this, you know, indefinitely.
Yeah. I mean, putting up the paywall, it felt solid, like I was going to be fine. But even at launch, I felt like I got a lot of attention, engagement. I feel like on that side, I'm just like very fortunate. I never felt this sort of like, it's never going to work, you know, like in some ways, I think like the second year of the newsletter was the hardest, even though I knew financially I was on good footing, just because like the first year you come out and you have all these ideas that your editor wouldn't let you write. And you like, you really know why you're doing it. And your friends are so engaged and like everybody's willing to help you for free. And then like your second year, it's like, you've got a business, like you're doing well, like, you know, it's just, and like, then it's much more like, oh my God, I've got to like do it all again. You know, I mean, that's the challenge with media over tech. It's like, you've got to keep coming up with hits. Then like the third year, I mean, I hired, you know, a chief of staff and now I have a reporter. So now it's becoming more of a company. So, you know, that takes some of the pressure off me. I'm still super busy. I feel like the problem when it was just me is I'd have a week where I had tons of meetings. It's like by any objective measure, I've been like super productive, but it like didn't translate into a great post. And it's sort of like, what if I, so then I'd be really, you know, upset that like I didn't have a good post. Whereas now with a reporter, we're going to have a great post every week. And then like when I, you know, can write, I'll write. And when I can't, I won't. And it won't be a crisis. And obviously I'm super involved in like what's going into that newsletter and editing and all that.
It's just, you're doing less of the blocking and tackling, like more like higher strategic priorities. Like it's a business. You're the CEO, right? Like you're running a media company.
Yeah. A word I never really say CEO. I mean, it's the classic early stage company where you're just like founder or whatever, writer. I mean, we haven't talked about this really yet, but like events are the business today. I mean, that is, yeah. So I'm spending a lot of time on events. It's like getting speakers, you know, getting, working with sponsors, like just trying to make the events come together. That is a huge part of where I see the growth opportunity. So that is the top priority for the business.
So why events? Like what makes them so good for the newcomer business?
I think one thing I didn't quite see when I launched the Substack was that people really wanted a sense of community and connection in the pandemic. Like there was a pandemic thing going on, you know, which is digital ways of connecting were super valuable because they really couldn't connect in person. So that was a great tailwind for the newsletter. And I think now people are totally back to normal and they've sort of moved all over the place also. And so I think there's more value than ever in in-person events. So I think there's some just sort of a shift in mood there. I really enjoy the events. It feels like I get to use my sort of sourcing relationship muscle, but like use it in a way that's much more like direct to the business and sort of, you know, get speakers there, invite people, like have VIP dinner. You know, it's like, I like that whole thing. I mean, and that's, you know, Kara Swisher's like model of journalism was have a huge event, get scoops, you know, build a media brand to sort of support the events. Like I'm not like inventing the wheel here, you know?
Yeah. And you make money on the events too, right? It's not just they drive subscriber growth.
Oh, no. Yeah. The events are in no way to drive subscribers. Like they are to make money for themselves. I mean, I hate to say this, but it's like the truth. You can just tell that people feel good about paying for tickets, sponsoring events. They know what they're getting. I think people just undervalue media and resent paying for subscriptions, even though I think it like makes sense. Like I'm giving you, it's a lot of work to produce the newsletter. Like now I'm doing events, which people are always like, that's a hard business. I'm like, media is like a very hard business to like continue to come up with like novel, valuable stuff. But people resent having to subscribe. And so I think it's nice being in a business where you feel like people are eager to, you know, they understand why they're parting with their money for something.
So you have an easier time getting people to sponsor the events than the newsletter?
Yeah. I think sponsors like events more. They know, they get to see the people, even though it's like the scale is smaller than the newsletter. And we sometimes bundle newsletter ads and stuff, so we have an advantage there that we can sort of combine them. So yeah, sponsorships are easier, definitely. But I also think, like, you know, for an event, I'll charge a VC like $1,600, whereas, you know, or this banking one is $1,000, whereas there's just like a limit, you know, on what I would reasonably. Some people do run these business publications where they have even more expensive paywalls, but then you're like really being read by like a small number of people. And it's like, I do want to be read, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes even like you send this email to 80,000, or how big is the free list right now?
The free list is like 80,000.
80,000. Okay. So I speak at the event, you know, only like a couple hundred people are there, but I get emailed to 80,000 people. Hey, CEO of like Databricks, you know, OpenAI and then Turner. I'm like up with them. Like, that's huge. Like, who would not want that, to have people like out, like think of you in that way?
You have the machine to make sure the events are covered and cool and like that it's a thing. I mean, media, you know, I also have great relationships with media. Like CNBC was on hand at the second Cerebral Valley. So it's like, yeah. So it's, they're also getting covered. Yeah. But yeah, they work really well together. And so that's great.
And so you basically, the business is, are you comfortable breaking down percentage of like revenue? Or
Axios wrote a story that I gave them the information on the record that we had crossed $1 million in revenue last year in 2023. And they my paid subscribers are like $400,000 of that, you know, so events are more, yeah, at least 600 of. So we have some newsletter sponsorships, I guess, but yeah.
And then I think, I don't know if you still actually have this. I just remember seeing it. You had a Discord group of some kind. Is that still a thing? Or
Casey Newton, a platformer who's doing very well and run as sort of, it's his brainchild. We like did it, I forget, like soon after launching the Substacks, because he like announced, I literally called him because he had this newsletter in The Verge being like, hey, I'm going to quit and do a Substack. And Casey's like, yeah, I'm about to announce Substack. And like, he, you know, had a huge New York Times profile like a couple days later. So we've been like, and we're very like supportive. We, you know, he covers social media and I cover sort of the business of startups and venture capital. So there's not much competition. We both recommend each other's newsletters and everything. So him, me, and some other people did this Discord group. I'd say my part of it has been a failure. I don't know. I didn't like it that much. Like, I don't know. I just felt the problem for me, I mean, is it just like the community, first of all, was a little negative on tech, which I'm more positive. And then it didn't attract like VCs, you know, it wasn't like a dealsy sort of thing. It was more like interest in the tech commentary. So to some degree, I felt like the things that people were talking about weren't really leading me to the best types of posts and what my typical reader wanted.
Yeah, because it seems like Casey covers more big tech and you cover small tech startups. So it's just like different audiences almost.
And there's much more like, you know, mine's culturally relevant, but I do like first and foremost want to cover like the money and then these sort of people that are known to the Valley and important to them. I have much less sort of ambition for it to be like the big conversation about Facebook, or, you know, like the Facebook beat is a little bit more like, you know, he has a New York Times podcast. It's a little more, you know, broad. Whereas I'm very open and direct that I'm like trying to fully saturate Silicon Valley startups and venture capital, but like not really interested in trying to get anybody outside of that because that's sort of a distraction.
Do you find it kind of ironic that you live in New York and you're covering San Francisco?
I'm very transparent. My Twitter says Crown Heights. I feel like people are constantly like shocked. I'm like, this is not a secret. I lived in San Francisco for 6 years. I still think San Francisco is the center of the tech universe. I believe in San Francisco. My now wife was at the time working for The New Yorker. So as New York a publication as you could have, and her family lives in New York. So I moved for love. And I mean, I honestly, like, the beauty of New York is that everybody like comes through. Like, it's not presumptuous to say like, hey, when will you be here? Like, let's get a meeting. So like, you can get more European VCs, you get the San Francisco people. So I feel like it works. But I, you know, obviously go to San Francisco a lot and have events there. And San Francisco is great because you like stumble into a restaurant and you find sources and tech people. And so it's like very efficient, but then it becomes like, oh my God, my whole life is like tech. I don't know. What do you think about this, sir?
Well, I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So it's...
You're like, you can do this anywhere. Yeah.
I mean, I'm in an even worse spot. Like, why would I pick Ann Arbor? Well, it's the same thing. It's family stuff. So
do you go to San Francisco a lot? Or like, what's your San Francisco versus New York? Like, do you come to New York ever for deals?
Yeah, it's probably about the same.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I would say LA, San Francisco, and New York. Those are probably like the three places I go the most. I probably do a trip every couple of weeks. Try to do like 3 to 5 days. It just, it kind of depends on kid stuff, my wife's schedule. It can kind of be challenging sometimes. Like, it's hard to do last minute trips sometimes, which I do them sometimes. And my wife is like, why did you do this to me with the kids? Like, based on some other external things going on.
To win deals usually, or like to close it, to get in a deal?
Yeah, it really just depends. There's sometimes my strategy is generally not like heat seeking into the hottest round. So I usually don't have to like jump on a flight that day and go meet a founder. But I usually do try to meet them after I invest. And sometimes it'll be like, hey, I'm going to be in New York in 2 weeks. Would you want to just get dinner when I'm there? And so, yeah, usually since I'm usually doing pre-seed and seed, and it's like I said, it's like I'm not doing a ton of AI investing. I've done a little bit, but like no one's interested in the stuff that I'm investing in. So
that's good. Yeah. So less diva-ish founder behavior.
Yeah. I don't know. And I try to like move fast with the founders, but it's also like, you know, I'm going to make a decision. Like, I've tried to be really transparent. I'm like, here's what I'm thinking about. But like, hey, next week I'll be in LA, like, or I can do a trip I've done before. It's like, you know what? I can probably get out there next week. We can just get breakfast or get coffee or something or dinner or whatever while I'm there. And then I usually think of them pretty strategically, where it's, if I'm in San Francisco, I usually try to record an in-person podcast or two.
Really establish that you're in San Francisco. Yeah, I guess I do that too. Like, I'm on the ground in San Francisco. Here's what's like going on, you know?
I just try to make them really efficient. And I don't get anything done while I'm there. Like, no, like, work. It's all just like, okay, 8 meetings this day. I'm exhausted. Like, you know, you're exhausted at the end because it was like, got up early. You get back to your hotel like 11 o'clock and it's like, man, I have so much I have to do before I go to bed. But yeah, you try to fit it all in. So I have a question. You invested in Substack. You mentioned there was this whole thing about like Substack is this new trend. You can finally participate on it. Like, it's a tool for you. You can invest. But then I think you ended up investing when Substack did this. And can you just kind of take us inside why you invested and what you like about Substack?
I invested, you know, through basically crowdfunding. It was WeFunder. It was $5,000. I mean, I said this in my... I'm very supportive of Substack. Like, I would not have quit my job without Substack. They did not offer me any... I didn't take money from them, and I didn't have, like, the pro deal, if people remember that. But they were supportive. They gave me advice. And, like, they've been supportive. You know, they helped pay for a podcast producer, editor at one point. And So, you know, I have a good relationship with them. And so it felt like an opportunity to throw my sort of support behind them. And just, so it's not a financial investment. You know, it's much more, given that they take 10% of my subscription revenue, like $5,000 wasn't some huge, you know, it's not the biggest financial calculus relative to that. Like, sort of good PR for them is like good for me. Like, I want, you know, I like their, like, you know, the Substack app and stuff is like somewhere, you know, I get subscribers. So I guess this is all a caveat on it was not a bet on like where their valuation was and like whether I'd make money on it. It was, I am throwing my support, getting a little more aligned with a platform that has been very supportive of me, that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing without, and give them a little bit of PR, you know, it's a small PR support that I can give them.
Yeah, well, I remember you had a really interesting line, and I'm probably not quoting it exactly, but it was something along the lines of, Substack will just come up with a new feature that just helps my business. Like, it's pretty awesome. Like, I don't have to do anything, and Substack grows my company for me. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dream. Like, they have a product team hard at work, and then they come up with something I had no idea, and it's like, great. Yeah, that, I mean, the biggest feature has been Substack recommendations. You know, where it's helped my free list a lot, like Pragmatic Engineer. Everybody should check that out, that newsletter out as well. It's about, especially if you're into engineering stuff, I mean, he's, I think he's the number one tech newsletter. So he's driven a ton of free subs to me from recommending. Yeah. So that's been super helpful. I mean, I do think Substack needs to pick it up a little bit. I mean, you know, they lost Casey at Platformer. Yeah. Are you an investor in Substack?
No, I really like the product. I think they're a lot of stuff they're doing is smart. The valuation is just super high.
Yeah, super high. I mean, Ghost and Beehive are clearly like gunning for them.
Yeah, I also did not invest in Beehive. That was probably just a bonehead decision. I met Tyler like the first two rounds. I will go on the record saying I'm probably an idiot for that one.
It seems like they're doing well as a business. I mean, Substack, you know, recently got in this whole drama about like Nazis on their platform.
Yeah, that was a huge deal. I kind of remember that.
I mean, I find it back to the original conversation about like opinion and everything, you know, obviously I like free speech, but I believe in like moderated platforms. Like if I were running a company, to me, I say this to Substack all the time. Like what I like about Substack is the informed debate, you know, and I feel like they can lean a little bit too hard into platform for anything. I think they still even let sort of accounts get monetization, you know, and I'm like, wow, you're like building tools for really questionable accounts to make money. I mean, they say there just aren't that many of them and they don't make that much money. I mean, it's annoying on principle and that I don't really agree with them, but it's also just annoying that like, I feel like that sort of right-wing free speech sort of thing is still a big part of their public identity. And I wish, yeah, they could get a little bit more like continue to grow and continue to get like a good narrative going about what they're doing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think Substack is pretty big outside of tech. Like if you just go into sports and just fashion, culture, those kind of things, like there are some, and well, even just like general politics, more of like down the fairway politics, I guess we'll say. It's massive there too. Like tech is a pretty small percentage of the readership, I'm pretty sure from my conversations with them.
Yeah, I think politics is a big part of it. I think the number one Substack is still Helen Cox Richardson, you know, the professor who writes about like history. I think she's like, you know, a Democrat type. I don't know. I don't follow it, but
yeah, I'm not the most into the politics discourse. I don't know what's going on most of the time. Well, so talking about not knowing what's going on, or you know, in the weeds, what do you think are some of the biggest kind of undercovered or under-discussed stories in tech right now? And I know, I mean, you kind of, maybe it's stuff you've written about, but.
No, I mean, I think the thing I struggle to write the most about is just the downturn part. You know, like I hosted Cerebral Valley, the AI part. I clearly leaned in to the AI boom, but I'm, you know, generally pretty like, you know, not negative. I mean, I'm, you know, I just try to be honest and, you know, push back on hype. You know, I certainly push back on some of the crypto hype. And I just feel like, you know, there was this AI boom, but a lot, you know, software was like in real trouble and like a lot of tech was struggling. And I think it's just much harder to cover the downturn, right? Like, you know, there are deal stories when you're doing well. They're just like aren't stories when you're struggling. It was hard to separate like the layoffs. Good companies and bad companies did layoffs. So I feel like it's been hard to cover the sort of correction in Silicon Valley. You know, we've done a lot of charts. I think that sort of helped.
Because that's objective. Like it's less opinion. It's just like, hey, objectively, these numbers are going down.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a big storyline that we've talked about is just, you know, at the end of 2022, I think people hoped that it was a reversion to the mean where, you know, we go back to the pre-pandemic level of enthusiasm. But then 2023, you know, was worse in terms of funding. And I think that was hard. And given my strategy overall is to cover like Sequoia benchmark doing deals, it's just harder. There's less to write about them just like not doing deals. So to me, that's just been undercovered because it's hard to turn into a story. Yeah. It's like you can do the data. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you had one where it was just like showing the pullback. Like I think it was like differences in number of investments made between 21 and or 22 and 23 or something like that. I remember that was a big story.
Yeah. We've been doing that. Yeah. Doing more charts because it's hard to cover with anecdote.
Yeah. So I know we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but I wanted to make sure we give like a good framework for people that are trying to, not just you, but just pitch their story to a journalist. I don't know if there's a good like going from zero to one or like good of like good landing a scoop, but like how should I do it? Like me, I'm trying to like pitch you like, hey, I've got this story I think you should cover. What do you want to hear from me or anyone when we're pitching you on something?
It is a relationship business. Like I feel like number one is like you want to be on somebody's radar before you're coming to them with a story.
So I shouldn't say like, hey, I got this company. They want to announce their round next week.
Well, I have the relationship with you, right? I mean, so one thing you can do is rely on your VC's relationships with a reporter to try to get it. Or like if you get a very savvy comms person, maybe their relationships with a reporter. But yeah, otherwise, you know, you try to meet them or you just want to be on their radar so that when it happens, it's like, oh yeah, that company is like executing on what I've heard. I mean, it's similar to like courting investors where it's like, it's good to be on their radar and then you outperform what they expect. And then, you know, because, you know, especially covering like Series A, there's a lot of like discernment in what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like zero revenue companies that raise a Series A that might never be a business. Like it's just hard to know what's actually real. Is,
I mean, core to the strategy is that you have this piece of news, usually a funding round that's exclusive, and you bring it to one person. You say, if you're willing to cover this, we'll give you the story exclusively. I feel like there are a lot of people who are early stage that still want to like blast it out to a lot of people, and then you get nothing. And so I think leveraging the sense that this is going to run exclusively with you is key to the strategy early on. I mean, I do think more and more like people are self-publishing. I think it's super valuable to have good writing about what you're doing and like explaining it. I do think Andreessen Horowitz is good at like writing posts about why they're investing in a company. And often those are better resources for the companies than themselves. You know, you should definitely, I feel like founders need to be good about articulating what's exciting technologically about their companies. So even though I'm pro reporter and pro announcing things in media, I think, you know, clearly we are in a moment where companies are doing more sort of direct themselves.
The hostility of some of it, like some of the stuff is like very like anti-media. We need to go around.
Yeah, like Bology. Like I feel like it's calmed down. Like, I mean, the crypto people were like super aggressive. I mean, Andreessen, you know, tried to build Future, which was meant to be a real media publication and failed. So I think they have been somewhat humbled in that, but they still, you know, mostly communicate themselves. I think some of the hostility is calmed down. I think it's interesting. Like, I mean, the Founders Fund guys like have somewhat been hostile to media, though also know how to cooperate with it. I mean, Mike Solana has this Pirate Wires Substack that he's trying to turn into a media company.
It seems like, yeah, I mean, from the outside, like going from zero to whatever they're at now, like it's worked to a certain extent. I don't know exact numbers, but like people care about it. That's important.
I mean, my position has always been like Godspeed. Like, I feel like if tech people have, you know, if you do the thing and then you understand like what readers want, like what stories work and like why people write stories the way they do. And, why, you know, you start to understand and it's like this, you know, it's funny to me that like the VC lens is usually like, I'll look at the economic incentives of somebody and like then understand what they're doing. And then I feel like on media, there's a lot of like anger at like the reporters when, you know, when like the normal lens would be a sort of a business model type decision. I don't know. That's sort of a hazy thing. These reporters do in some ways. I think the challenge of reporting is that they've operated from the mindset of the monopoly days of media, right? Like reporters, media had a monopoly. So they had all this money. So we had this wonderful like priesthood of media where it was like, this is what journalism ethics look like. And we operate outside of the business side. And in fact, if the business side is trying to meddle, that's like a problem. It's like, unlike most businesses where obviously your product is very aligned with the business. And so, yes, there was like this big set of media that was operating sort of uneconomically.
Yeah. And that's changed because the internet just kind of changed the way people get information. So instead of getting it from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, there's like, it's like a founder that just blasted it on Twitter or LinkedIn. The algorithm picks it up
But that also made the media more negative, because then if all the positive stories are coming directly from the companies, the only differentiated stories are sort of the negative ones. And so then the media is even more negative because you're not announcing positive stuff with the media. So then they become more and more negative.
It's kind of challenging too. Like for me, I know how hard it is to start a company. Like it's super hard. And like the way to get through it is just like praise the things that go well. Like you just think constantly things are breaking and not going well. So it's like, oh man, we raised some money or we hit a milestone, signed a new customer, new product launch. Like it's exciting to celebrate those things. You don't want to come out and be like, hey, our revenue dropped this year, or, you know, a bunch of our customers are churning, or we're having this like turmoil in the business. Like it can almost feel like, especially if you've like kind of been inside some of them, like when people are amplifying those things can be really, really frustrating. So,
you know, I am pro tech largely, you know, like tech people are building businesses that are, you know, meant to make people's lives easier. They're selling people products that people want. And, you know, reporters can sometimes, I feel like my biggest criticism of media is that stories aren't rooted in what's the best alternative. Or it's like, if you're tearing something down, like what is the positive view of the world that you subscribe to? And I think there's a lot of just like been too much like tech bros and just like hostility without the burden of saying, this is what I'm trying to build. I suspect some of what they're trying to build is a more like socialist sort of world, which I think if they had to articulate, many people would oppose. And so there's this sort of, you know, hostility without an articulated worldview. And that definitely frustrates me with the media.
Yeah. So I guess maybe a good way to start, you know, wrapping up, winding down the conversation. If someone, like, just say I was coming to you, like, I want to start my own media company, how would you tell someone to approach it? Like, what are some things that surprised you?
Well, yeah, I literally had this conversation with a reporter who was thinking about it the other day. I'm surprised more people don't try. I mean, the number one thing is like any business, which is know who your customer is. You know what I mean? You have to have a sense of a customer that you're going after. And I think that's challenging, especially for reporters. It's like, okay, you're building a publication about, you know, is it for business people trying to make money? Is it for the consumer? Like, I think having a sense of who your customers are going to be is key. And then, I mean, I just believe in like great stories, you know, like at the end of the day, like the product is the writing, you know? And so having information people want or writing style people believe in is super valuable. But there's so many different ways to make them work. You know, like I am very fortunate in writing about a very profitable, or not profitable, an industry with a lot of money.
The management companies are profitable.
So yeah, so I would never want to be seen as being in this position of like, I figured it out and why can't everybody do what I do? It's like, I cover the easiest thing to cover. So like, of course, I feel like I've figured it out. Ryan Broderick has this great Substack called Garbage Day. And you know, he sort of outlined, I think he saw like three different reasons that people subscribe. Like some of it is like this parasocial relationship, you know, where people are very like tied in with like a writer or a Twitter personality. And then they subscribe, you know, there's clearly more my world where it's like for information. So I do think there are very different reasons newsletters work in sort of different relationships with the reader.
Wow. He has got quite the headlines. I just pulled up his Substack. Putin should have gone on Hot Ones.
He's great, honestly. He's very like, yeah, he's good.
Elmo's big week. And then Mr. Beast screwed up Elon's pyramid scheme. Those are, I mean, I kind of want to click on those and read why.
He worked at BuzzFeed. So he has that, you know, that sense like we got to get him excited about this.
So that's almost probably like a consumer that he's, or it seems like actually maybe there's like a bit. So it's probably like if you're B2B focused, you can probably get by with the subscription. But if you're more of a consumer business, you're probably going to have more of an ad based model. Is that fair to say? Or
it's good to have multiple revenue streams. I mean, I want to have more sponsors. It's just sponsoring the, you know, it's like I said earlier, it's easier to sell sponsorships to the events.
Just generally, like I've had a couple, I don't know, media people with media driven businesses. So where it's like a prior guest was Craig Fuller. He has this company called Freight Waves. You know, it's reporting and media on the logistics business, but his business is kind of like Bloomberg where he sells like data software.
I know. I want to get into that over time. Freight Waves is like a great, that's like a, I feel like that comes up a lot in sort of niche businesses that are doing well.
Yeah. And another really interesting one, it's a company called Epic Gardening. He's like the biggest like gardening media company on the internet, like blog, YouTube. He's like the biggest account on like TikTok, Facebook. And initially it was, you know, sponsorships, media, like that kind of stuff, revenue share on YouTube, a couple hundred K in revenue, got up to, I think just around a million, I think, if I'm remembering our conversation right. And then he started selling his own products. And then he actually acquired a seed distributor, like a wholesaling seed company that like just sells the seeds to like gardening centers.
I've been reluctant to say this, but I say it sort of in private. You know, to some degree, it's like building a media business. You realize you have a great content marketing business without a product to sell, you know, and that is in some ways the events. It's like, okay, you can convene people, you have attention, you have relationships, but you're not like selling them sort of a great product. Like media is, like I've been saying, sort of not necessarily the best product. And so then you see businesses get attention, which actually, you know, lots of real businesses, traditional or whatever, other kinds of businesses struggle to do. And then they need to find a much better way to monetize attention besides just advertising and subscription revenue. And so, like you're saying, yeah, sell other things adjacent to what you're writing about.
Yeah, I'm thinking about your business. It's like, okay, the Substack, a lot of people subscribe for free, decent chunk, what is them, like maybe 4% are paid and pay you $200 a year. And then your conferences, I think you threw out ticket prices a lot higher than the paid subscription. But at the end of the day, the subscribers in the newsletter are like your marketing for the events, and your CAC, like you're making money. You have a profitable media business that then ties into the events. So it's like your CAC is negative, like your customer acquisition costs, like you're making money from your thing that you're using to sell the actual product. So when you really like dig down into, you know, initially you might start this media business, it's like purely media. As you keep working yourself down the funnel, like the media side is almost not even like the main business. Like it is, but it's not at the same time.
It's core to your reputation, your relevance, but it's not necessarily the best way to monetize. And that's, I'm totally focused on startup and venture capital. I feel like some people, you know, like you build a media thing, you're like, oh, I'm going to build a broader media thing, and that's how I'm going to monetize. I'm like, I'm staying in startups and venture capital, and maybe I have other business lines sort of besides, you know, the ones I have today.
Yeah. I mean, you already have the trust of your audience. It's like, hey, we're building this new, like we started an event, you should come to the event, and you're able to attract good speakers to the event because of the trust that you built up. And I think that's why I went. I was like, oh, seems pretty interesting. Like this is probably going to be a pretty good event to go to. Like I want to go. So I'm bummed that I can't make it this year. I just have another commitment in Michigan. So.
Well, this is the banking one. I'll do another Cerebral Valley in the second half of the year.
Well, I wanted to go to the banking one. The banking one, I think it's coming out a week. It's a week after this episode.
Yeah, March 14th. So if people hear this and are scrambling to get tickets, I don't know. Like, I feel like, you know, there's always an ebb and flow of like, you know, in the beginning you want to like lock in tickets just for peace of mind. And then I always underestimate how much people are like, their friends are going. And so then they're scrambling, you know, to try and, it's invite only, but you can, you know, you can email me at, email actually newcomer@newcomer.co. You'll get a couple of us if you desperately need to go to a banking event.
Yeah. So what is this thing? It's the Newcomer Banking Summit. Is that what it's called?
Yeah. It's the Newcomer Banking Summit. Sorry. I'm like not a good enough pitch man here. Thank you. I mean, I do think we'll be mostly sold out by the time this airs, but the idea is it's looking back at the 1 year anniversary of the Silicon Valley Bank crisis. So it's sort of we're good at like putting together these like lean events in the moment, you know, not something necessarily the Wall Street Journal is going to spin up. So it's like a third looking at back at the SVB crisis, a third, the state of commercial technology banking today, and a third like future finance and fintech. We've got the SVB president speaking, we've got the CEO of Mercury speaking, we've got a top tech bankers at HSBC and JP Morgan and Stifel. Yeah, we have a Jackie Reese's of Lead Bank, who's super big in the fin. I didn't realize how big of a like banking celebrity she was until we announced that, but she's also sort of an ex-top Square executive, Block executive. So yeah, I think it's like I've sort of been hammering. It's, you know, it's for insiders. It's like for the bankers and startup founders, people who want to do deals with these. You know, the thing we're proudest about with Cerebral Valley is, and I say this all the time, but
There's some deals that got done there, right?
Right. I at the beginning of the first Cerebral Valley, I like threw down the gauntlet. And I said, we need like $100 million deal to happen here. And like I'd underestimated what would happen because Ali Goetze, the CEO of Databricks, met Naveen Rao, Mosaic ML, at our speaker dinner.
Wow. Yeah, they acquired them.
Yes, for $1.3 billion. And like Ali has talked about this in Fortune. He like came back to the second conference and talked about it. So I'm very appreciative to them on how open they've been that sort of kicked off this conversation. But yeah, that's what we want. We want like billion-dollar deals to happen out of these events. And it's super exciting. And I like playing that sort of connector role while, you know, having events that feel like, oh, you were there when like this very newsy and sort of, but sort of about the actual business and like focused on how people are building things. So it's super satisfying.
And then you kind of take the recordings too, and you put them online. That's even more just, yeah.
I write about it in the newsletter. So it's, you're getting this sort of insider thing, but then, you know, the subscribers get sort of access to everything that happened.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I know we probably got to wind down in a minute here, but curious, like what can you share about future of newcomer? Anything we should be looking out for?
Yeah. I mean, I think just, you know, the event strategy is going to be where are there, you know, an event that many venture firms would have a partner dedicated to this, like sort of, I've teased maybe a gaming event, you know, so sort of a consumer venture conference where it's like the sponsors, the readers are sort of consistently interested, but then the actual attendees are like, okay, you wanted sort of a fintech one, you wanted an AI one, you wanted a gaming one. So it's the same feel, but then we're going after sort of different people. So we're not asking the same people to come to event after event. And it's got that same vibe where it's like, you know, hopefully 50% like startup founders, who, you know, people want to meet, and good ones. And then like a quarter investors and then some corporates. And, you know, then it sort of depends on the industry. So I think I'm hiring an events person. So please definitely newcomer@newcomer.co. If you're interested in that, I'm sort of going back and forth whether we want a junior or sort of hungry person or somebody who's really experienced. So very open to sort of that role if we find the right person. And then, I mean, I think longer term, I'm interested in like, how do you get sort of private market sort of analyst reports, or, you know, there are crypto businesses and others that have had a lot of success.
Yeah. What could you do there? I'm just trying to think of like what's not being done and what are you set up for? I mean, you could maybe do like private interviews or something with insiders. Is that?
Yeah, people, I mean, aren't you with Turpentine? Like, I think he's super, Eric.
Yeah, Eric's super, yeah, super into that.
Like the TGIS sort of strategy. I'm a little more skeptical that like the cutting room floor of my notes is that good. Like, I honestly think like so much of the value is like, oh my God, I have this disaster of an interview. Like, how do I make it gripping to the reader? And like, if you just hand people transcripts, like you're asking way too much of them. So I think people want the narrative, even if they think they want like some random tidbit that's buried in the story. But I do think, you know, Databricks, Stripe, like I think trying to get into this, you know, like pre-IPO, like what's going on with those companies could be super. I mean, the dream would obviously be to create some sort of pre-analyst call type thing, or a sort of, you know, like they're trying to show information before they go public. The challenge is just, you know, there's all this public disclosure in the public markets that you don't have in the private markets. So, you know, I love what Contrary is doing, but I do think they're limited in some ways by just like, you don't have the numbers. And so I haven't solved that problem, but I think coming up with some type of analyst report on like the big unicorns could be interesting.
Yeah. You just kind of take like the full life cycle. Like somebody raises their first round, you cover that, or those are the people subscribed. And then just throughout their, you know, the next 10 years, like, you're almost still, you know, quote unquote, monetizing the relationship, or like you're, it's a relationship. It's not just like extracting value, but like it's for your business. Like you,
right. It's good for them too. It's symbiotic. Like you're like, oh, I believe in this company. That's why I'm writing about it. And like, and then, so yeah, you know them when, but I haven't totally solved the problem on like what they look like.
In interviews, it seems like that's an interesting place that you've kind of hit on the niche. I don't know how well those do. But then like also the leaks, like when you talk about your competitive set, people doing similar things, no one's really like leaking in a quality way or like scooping things in a quality way. I mean, maybe you just that's, you'd lean more into that. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I do think we'll hire more reporters over time and like continue to focus on exclusive financial information. I mean, there are all these secondary markets things that are happening. You know, a weakness to me of PitchBook is that it's incentivized to have a very long tail and to focus on all these firms and have data, but then the data quality isn't necessarily 100%. Whereas I think our strategy as a newsroom has been like great coverage of like Sequoia, Andreessen, Benchmark, and a belief that like there's a lot of attention on those firms. And so if we did a data strategy, it would have a similar philosophy where it's like people really want to know a lot of information about top unicorns and top venture firms and less like the breadth necessarily of data.
Yeah. I mean, another interesting one, which benefits me, is like leaning into the emerging category of it is like, you know, you can get whatever you want about Sequoia, but you want to learn about this new venture fund that they just raised their first fund, or, you know, they're really obscure. Like, how do you find out about them?
I mean, part of what I try to do is say who's cool among like a very nerdy set. You know, it's like, yeah, which emerging managers are like have the juice and like are getting the deals before they have the returns. You know, it's sort of because there's so much like, you know, the data, the sort of numbers in venture lag sort of who's connected. And so, yeah, I think what we're trying to do, you know, what we do with emerging managers is try to find the people that have the right LPs and have that sense that they're going to get the companies that get attention.
Yeah, that's fair. Awesome. Well, this is a really cool conversation. Thanks for opening up the curtain on how Newcomer works. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a blast.
Thank you for listening. If you don't want to miss future episodes of The Peel, subscribe to my newsletter, The Split, in the show notes, and you'll get new episodes plus the transcripts in your inbox. If you want to support the show, share this episode with a founder who could learn a thing or two about the world of media and the press. Thanks again to Eric for coming on. Thanks to you for listening. Hope you enjoyed. See you next episode.